Going back before the fall that giving enough, let's say, because in a group such as this or any group, there will be those who have acquired more and those who have acquired more debts. And on this basis, we end up some people having more than others, and if this goes on for generations, there will be people who are reduced to grinding poverty. And so God established a jubilee. You give every man a chance at least once in a lifetime to start over again, to be released from all of the mistakes that he might have made in the past 50 years, economically speaking. We live in a world that does not observe. The Jews live in a world that does not observe. Jesus Christ is going to come to a world that has not been, but shall observe. What we do not do now is an administrative matter, not a matter of our recognition of law and authority behind the law. So we had our crises in the 1780s, as I said in Bible studies, and I'll repeat it again so you'll never forget. In the 1830s, the Grover Cleveland crisis, you remember, in the 1880s, if you were reading history or you have parents who were still living. The 1930s, which should be, for many of you who are older, clear in your memory. And now we are headed toward the 1980s. We're headed into an economic crisis, with the winds already blowing in that direction. I do not foresee that it's coming in 79. Some thought there was going to be a crash then, you know, they wrote books. Or 1980, or even 1981. But I wouldn't overlook the implications of 1982 in terms of what we have to discuss this afternoon. So we have the recognition on this Feast of Trumpets, the beginning of a civil year, the sabbatical year, of course, beginning on the Day of Atonement when they announced both the Jubilee and the sabbatical years, that there are things that administratively are not the responsibility of the Church of God today, but laws that the land should be observing at the level of the state, and the state is not. And therefore, in the church or out of the church, Jews or non-Jews, Christians or non-Christians, the whole world suffers from the fact that if there is not a readjustment twice a century, there are crises that do it in entirely different and unfortunate ways. And I believe that we should take heed to the implications of the law of God, even those laws which were never destined to be administered by the New Testament ministry or by you as an individual, but were to be a part of the whole fabric of society. See, the Bible has laws that regulate my personal private life, laws that regulate my life and society as I have to bring with it, and our relationship as human beings to God. And then there are laws that govern society as a whole. That is, the more people you have, the more need there is of doing certain things that would not have to be done if we were just a few scattered individuals. But we cannot impose, and have been given no authority to take as a church a responsibility that is a function of state. And the sabbatical year and the Jubilee were essentially functions of state that regulated indebtedness, regulated property. Jesus was asked, you remember on one occasion, I have a brother, this fellow said, and he won't divide his inheritance with me, I want to sit as a judge. And he said, who made me a judge in your case? He was uncalled to that role. So we have today some very important thoughts. This is the one day that determines the calendar. The calendar is determined on the basis of when this day, the Feast of Trumpets, should fall. And the spring festivals and the autumn festivals fall in this connection because this day has been established. I think that's very significant. And in terms of the calendar, the star and stone was the person used in this century to straighten out the churches of God in the 1930s. And that is why we observe it today. We're not dealing with the question today of whether the Pharisees did something else. That is a separate matter, and someday I will address that question specifically as to what happened from the middle of the first century to the middle of the fourth century, when the Pharisaic method differed. But today we are regulated by the calendar that the Jews were forced to go back to in 359 AD, when the Romans forbade them to convey any message of observation, and they were reduced again to the calendar of calculation that we responsibility of the church now is to convey, especially to this country and to other areas of the English-speaking world, the message of Ezekiel. We thought that things would have ramped up much earlier because things did point in a certain direction, politically, economically, militarily, and religiously. And there were also things we didn't notice along the way. And so I would like to take you briefly back on this day to experiences that might be of some importance to those of you who came to a knowledge of this word only in the middle of the 70s or the early 70s and have not lived through the decades of this century. In the 1930s, Mr. Armstrong's glimpse of prophecy led him to see very clearly, before many others, that there was a man who was used in the restoration of the Roman Empire, who raised a king of Italy to the level of emperor. This man, Benito Mussolini, who enabled the royal family in Italy to become an imperial family. Mr. Armstrong saw with the man who assisted his king restoring the Roman Empire. The British were aware of it. The Americans have not been. The only two basic books that have ever been written in the English language, to my knowledge, on this subject were written by Englishmen. One clearly spoke of Mussolini's Roman Empire. The other spoke of the rise and fall of the new Roman Empire. Now, this was the story of the Mediterranean world and of Italy. Its conquests, first in Libya and Eritrea, Ethiopia, not to mention along the Adriatic, attempts in Greece, and then linking up across the Alps with another man who founded the third restoration of the German Reich or Empire, the same system that in the north. Mr. Armstrong in the 1940s wondered whether Mussolini was to be followed by Hitler. We're dealing with an axis it was as good as our money is today. As I said this morning, Joseph Stalin, before he died, thought that India would become communist by 1955, and he foresaw the world revolution of the Communist Party, ultimately ending capitalism by the middle of the 70s. It was the wave of the near future. Joseph Stalin was wrong. India is not communist yet. Long since has 1975 passed. The extreme rightists, knowing that the communists in the United States were seriously thinking, creating a revolution, a terrorist country apart by 1972, in their own published documents, used that very date to indicate that there would be battle between left and right. But they did not count on President Nixon, who came in before. And who knew the mind of the extreme left and did what no other man perhaps could have done. He infiltrated the extreme left and tore it apart from within by knowing every major move they planned. Watergate was just a part of the story that was so poorly executed it ultimately brought about his demise as the President of the United States. The communist plan to destroy this country from within in the early 70s came to nothing. The rightists had nothing to combat them with because there was no left to do the job that the right would have required. Nobody is on an extreme in one side or the other unless there are extremes on both sides doing their thing. But when the left was put to rest, the right had nothing to do battle with. This does not mean we do not have both parties, but it does mean that the press and the stress and the pressure that could have torn this country apart in the 1970s by 72 didn't occur. In fact, a major event occurred in the Middle East. The Israelis ripped the Arab world apart and have perhaps psychologically damaged them for a whole generation in the Six-Day War. A battle so significant in history that perhaps there is nothing like it since the days of Joshua. And the pressure and the stress that was building up in the Middle East that led us all to wonder if the crisis just before the Six-Day War was building to a climax was like a spring where the pressure is suddenly released. And 1968 and 69 and 70 and 71 and 72 went by, and we had the October War, the Yom Kippur War in 73, and the Israelis learned for the first time that there was something more to warfare than an Arab with a weapon to destroy an Israeli tank. And almost every family in Israel lost a man. The Arabs also learned in that war that whereas the Arab cannot be allowed to be conquered by Judah, Judah is not allowed to be conquered by the Arab. And now a whole new phase has been heard. The Egyptians saw in 73 that as long as the United States and Russia remained the two great powers, there was no solution via war. There had to be some alternative. Arabs may think other thoughts publicly, but in privately they all know it. There is no way to dislodge the state of Israel. Which brings us to the fact that 72 and 73 and 74 and 75 have gone by, 76 and 77 and 78 and 79 have almost disappeared. This is the last festival season we shall have in the 1970s, and we shall then be in the 1980s. Perhaps if you were born late, this might not seem unusual, but when you were born in the turn of the century, or 20 years later, or 30 years later, you see things in different perspectives. received, of course, during this time was a real understanding of the time frame of events. We have known that somewhere in the early 1980s, on the basis of Daniel 4 and 5, that some event should be occurring. We are aware, we have read in the book of Daniel, in chapter 4 of this remarkable tree, that was in the dream of the king, Nebuchadnezzar. We are in the year 562 B.C. after Nebuchadnezzar's insanity and restoration to the throne. He writes the story. We have seen this in connection with chapter 5 and perceived that since Babylon fell in 539 B.C., the late summer, early autumn, wasn't all in one event, it was a period of time. We have seen, without any question, that there should be some significant event in 1982. I would like us to take a look at the implication of our thoughts. We have rather loosely called this entire period of 2,520 years, or seven times, the time being taken as a prophetic 360 years on the basis of statement in Numbers and Ezekiel and the implications of Revelation 13. The time is a year has 360 days, and a day is taken for a year. For those of you who have not thought about that matter before, we have published little articles from time to time on the subject. You see, initially there was a calendar that was just solar before the solar lunar one. Because when God told Adam about the sun and the moon, determining times and seasons, it was left to the family of man to apply the interrelationship and to create the information and the knowledge that would lead to a solar lunar calendar, which is what we have when we use the Hebrew calendar. But from the time of the creation of man and through the flood and through the history of Egypt, there was also a parallel solar calendar of 12 months, 30 days to a month. And there were some days, generally five, outside of the year. That's the way it was structured. And so within the standard year, which we might liken to a business calendar today, there were 360 days. And the prophecies are based on that kind of a solar calendar that was something simple for man to start with. And so we have thought of the seven times or 7 years of Nebuchadnezzar's insanity as the typical of 2,520 years duration from 539 B.C. to 1982. At the moment, it would be easy for you, man, to add those two figures. You'll come out with 2,521, but you have to subtract one because there's no year zero. You're all familiar, or should be, with that. We've loosely seen this period as the times of the Gentiles, although that word is not used in the book of Daniel. Jesus used it, and he referred specifically, not to this period, but specifically to a 3.5-year period, the crisis at the close. He said, now, when you see Jerusalem trodden with armies, and he spoke about Jerusalem shall be trodden with armies, and when the times of the Gentiles doing that is being brought to a conclusion, Jesus Christ would be intervening in world affairs. This last century, the 19th, as well as this 20th century, has been a time, not of Gentile domination of the world, it's been a time of the domination of the children of Israel. Beginning at the close of the 18th century, and all through the 19th and the 20th, the dominant powers have been Great Britain and France and the United States and the Dutch and the Belgians and the Danes. If you want to look at the imperial realms of the world, it was the merchant ships of the United States and Britain in particular that dominated the shores of South America and Southeast Asia. It was the states of Israel and Northwestern Europe that carved up Africa, occupied the island continent of Australia, New Zealand, Tasmania, took over such areas of Asia as India and Indochina, the Dutch East Indies and the Philippines, late Spanish before. It was a time, if you please, when the children of Israel dominated the commerce and the transportation, the sea, and finally
Now, in this case,
has sought me, and I was established in my kingdom, and still more greatness was added to me. End of verse 36. Now, in one sense of the word, this might be of some historical interest. It also is of personal interest in terms of how God deals with the ruler. But it is not the whole story, because what happens here should have meaning beyond the times of Daniel, beyond the question of the relationship of God to man. And indeed, when we look at the fact that the very next chapter is number 5, 23 years later in 539 B.C., we begin to understand why these two events are put together. Other sections of the book of Daniel that fit in between are missing. But here are two chapters put together side by side. One, the time of his restoration to power, Nebuchadnezzar in 562. The other, 23 years later, Belshazzar, the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar on the mother's side, his father was King Nabonidus. He made a great feast at Babylon. His father had been away in Teman in Arabia, where a thousand of his lords and drank wine in front of the thousand himself. He had at the banquet. And he so enjoyed himself on that occasion, he saw no reason why the gold and silver vessels that Nebuchadnezzar brought from the temple shouldn't be brought here on this occasion. Now the armies of Persia and Media were wandering around the empire. And the city, of course, was under siege. But he was not concerned, because the walls certainly would protect Babylon. And just like any marauding army, the Medes and the Persians were still weak. So why not? And adequately to give it a whole thought. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and the queen mother came in, suggested to the king, who was second in command, his father was the first in command, to have Daniel offer interpretation, because in Nebuchadnezzar's day, he was able to explain what nobody else was able to do. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. So he was brought before the king and properly introduced. Now I have heard, the king said in verse 16, that you can give interpretation to the child's problem. Now if you can read the writing and make known to me its explanation, you can be the third ruler. My father's the first, I'm the second, you can be third. The Daniel suggests you keep his gifts. Verse 17. Gave Nebuchadnezzar your father, that really refers to grandfather, but it makes idiomatic use of the day of an ancestor of the father. And you remember what happened to him when his heart was lifted up, he was deposed. Now we have a link, there's some connection with this event and what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. What happened to Nebuchadnezzar was a personal event in his life. What was about to happen here was an event befalling the kingdom. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar was the type of the kingdom. Now, your grandfather was driven from among men. He lost his sanity. Now, you, his heir, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. But you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. The vessels of his house have been brought in before you, and you and your lords and your wives, your concubines, have drunk wine from them. You praise the gods of your own hand. So from his presence, the hand was therefore sent. Daniel, in this case, explained the consequence, in a sense, even before the vision. He pointed out their sin. The days of Nebuchadnezzar, he did the reverse. He explained everything, and then he suggested to him appropriately that he could have tranquility if he would break off his sin. Here he told them that they knew better all along. But now they get to the interpretation. Then from his presence, God in heaven, the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed. And he reached it here as Mayday, Hakel, and I'm reading from the RSV, Parthene. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mayday means, not means just a single word, but he says, in a sense, it means God has numbered. It has reference to the word number. God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel means
So Daniel, you'll note, only interpreted Mene 1. And he did not even use the full form Farsi, he used only the form Perez, without the implication of the plural, which is very interesting when you see the rest of the story. It's as if Daniel were giving, if you please, one possible explanation, the one that was important that night. But the handwriting was on the wall for a much longer period of time in terms of its impact on history. It is on the wall in the sense for us all to read here. We'll get back to that in a moment. Belshazzar, a purple and gold Daniel, he was arrayed that he should be now accepted as the third ruler of the kingdom for having given an explanation that meant that everything was finished. But kings are like that, you know, they celebrate just before they die. That very night, we are told, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. They took certain things for granted, that they would be protected by the gate. And the hand, if you please, that wrote on the wall, ordered the gate to be opened while they were all there. God opened those gates to his angelic messengers, and the Medes and Persians came in because nobody could have opened them, and they knew the Medes and the Persians couldn't open them from the outside. And they never bothered to set guards. Because Babylon was sure to last forever. Darius the Mede took the kingdom there, Cyrus over the Persians fought, and the Babylonians were defeated on the field, and Nabonidus surrendered. All this took place in the late summer to the beginning of autumn, and Cyrus then, in the month of Tisri, or September, October, marched into Babylon in 539, a date for which there can be no doubt, both on the basis of the business documents of the time, historians' records that proceed from then on, and the knowledge of the Hebrew calendar, with all of its 13 months that show clearly that we can lay out every single year from then till now, without a single loss of a year. So that was settled in the church in 1972 when somebody challenged that and was no longer with us. Who admitted that this was indeed a correct date and he was wrong. Now, take a look at this story again. What are these two chapters doing with Nebuchadnezzar's temporary insanity of restoring the power? God does rule, that's nice to know. But is that all? And here's the story of the fall of Babylon. Well, other nations have fallen too. Why was this chosen? Well, we might consider the fact that Isaiah, Jeremiah early, and John much later wrote that the final power on the world's face is called Babylon the Great. Not Persia or Media or Macedonia or Greece, not even Rome the Great. It is called Babylon the Great for a reason. I want you to take some thought of that. That a final power, all the chapters of Revelation, and in the closing chapters of Jeremiah, some of the earlier chapters of Isaiah, refer to Babylon as a symbolic name for the ultimate power. And they use the ancient Babylon as a type. It's almost the same as saying, if you didn't read any further, that when ancient Babylon fell, was succeeded by these other evil states. Though they perpetuated the same basic system of human government, we come to the place that the final one in the sequence cannot rise until the period of time has elapsed. pointing at you yet from the fourth chapter. But in the fifth chapter, let us look and see that there is also confirmation here. We have Mene, Mene, Tekel, Parthene, interpreted as Mene, Tekel, and Peres. Now let's note that this was one interpretation, but the word M and N, translated Mene, with one kind of vowel sound added, can also be interpreted as a minor. Now a minor is a half talent. And since Babylon was gold, this minor had 50 shekels. There were 60 shekels of silver in a silver minor, but for gold there were 50 shekels. So a minor meant 50 shekels. Now the reason I'm introducing weights is that Daniel says the interpretation is to number and to weigh and to divide. That's what he said. And he expounded it, and politically it means divided between means and version. Morally, your weight is found wanting, and number means your days have been brought to an end. But it could just as well literally mean to number and to weigh and to divide. And if we look at these in terms of what you can number, weigh, and divide, you're dealing with weight. And you're dealing with a head of gold. And therefore you're dealing with a gold talent, and a mina is a half a talent made up of 50 shekels. But there were two minas, mene, mene, mina, mina. So that was two 50 shekel weights of gold. And then a shekel, the Aramaic shekel was the Hebraic shekel, was one. And the Perez was a half mina, or 25. So you have ultimately 50 and 50, and 1 and 25, or 126 shekels. Now a shekel, we are told, can be still divided once more. Exodus 30:13, there are 20 gerahs in a shekel. 20 gerahs in a shekel, 126 shekels of gold times 20, 126 times 20 is 2520. So whether you think of it in terms of seven times, as it is in chapter 4, or whether you think of it in terms of two minas, a shekel and a half a mina, or 126 shekels, times the number of gerahs in a shekel, you can divide and weigh it out, and you ultimately have 2520 shekels. Someone could easily put together the implication. Easily put together the implication that as Nebuchadnezzar had 7 years, literal, of insanity, and was restored to power as the ruler, after that period of time, that was 2520 days, Babylon, here, as an ancient power, before the final Babylon of prophecy, must endure a period also of 2520, in this case, the same number, but it is made up of gold pieces, not just made up of dates, but the same figures. The implication, then, very clearly when you put both chapters together, is that as Nebuchadnezzar was the type of the kingdom, so also we have here the treaty, the type of Nebuchadnezzar and the type of this kingdom, and here the fall of Babylon in the very next chapter put together, one right after the other, we both clearly would have an implication that when Babylon fell as a nation, a lengthy period of 2520 years would elapse before its restoration, the same as Nebuchadnezzar had. 7 times for 2520 days elapsed before he was restored. And on this premise, we have for a long time seen that the early 1980s were very important in terms of world events. But the implication from this further, which we may now see more clearly in the end of September 1979, is that instead of the Babylon of prophecy of Revelation, the parts of Jeremiah and Ezekiel, I should say Jeremiah and Isaiah, ending not later than 1982, the implication, brethren, that we didn't see years before, is that 2520 years would elapse before the power of Babylon is restored, just like 7 times or 2520 days elapsed before Nebuchadnezzar was restored to the throne. We were somewhat confused in terms of the state of mind and the state of heart. draw the conclusion inevitably on the basis of what we know politically in Europe, that the Europeans will not be able to put together a political power before 1982. Somewhere in the later part of that year, we can expect a series of events politically to be required, because there is also the implication that an economic crisis is likely, this was not prophesied based on the Jubilee, is likely to occur beginning somewhere in the early 1980s. I didn't say this was a depression. I didn't say what it is, but it is an economic crisis. It is the kind of thing that requires some level of government higher than anything before in Europe to meet the challenge. It is a crisis that would seem to indicate the need of regulating prices and wages to prevent either a depression or an inflation from exploding out of hand. And it ultimately leads to the fact that you won't even be able to buy or sell without specific supervision, but that's getting into the prophecies we don't have time for today. We call it government intervention. And we are living in a world in which the economy is not allowed to get rid of its natural economic fever, the result of the sin of not keeping sabbatical of Jubilee years. But they keep drugging society until we have our present stagflation. And the doctor of the government must be called in more often and more often, but to keep the patient from either, you know, having a heart attack and dying, or a fever that goes in the other direction. It is very likely, on the basis of this, that when Mr. Armstrong continues his work, China, who knows what other countries, that's for God that he died, while this work has a responsibility in terms of reaching the nation again with the message of Ezekiel, to do what Mr. Armstrong did the generation before his time. He warned people who have come and gone, some were still around, but what would happen, many of whom will come up in the second resurrection and remember that they were told that they did nothing about it. They may have died in peace, but there in the second resurrection they can look back to 1,000 more years of history and see that indeed it happened, but not when they were told it might. But because they wondered about when, decided to do nothing about it, they ended up in the second resurrection. Those who took warning seriously ended up in the first. But our responsibility is to a new generation that didn't hear the message in the 30s and 40s and 50s or the earlier 60s. And that has been told the ministry that we should take note of our responsibility as a church. We may therefore look down the next few years and recognize we have a responsibility to accomplish before there is a political structure in Europe that could be perceived prophetically, politically, not just economically, as the rebirth of the kind of power that ultimately was Babylon. Let us note, however, Matthew 24, where Jesus says that we should take note of the event in chapter 24, verse 15. You can find it elsewhere in the account in Mark or Luke. Now, when you see the Decalating Sacrilege spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Let the reader understand. There's a tendency to assume that we know who the beast is. We don't yet. You may surmise, but let me point something out as we draw this to a close. In 1928, the British wrote in their encyclopedia that there is a politician in Germany who recently lost an election who will probably never again be heard of. So we can dismiss him from the scene. His name was Adolf Hitler. 4 years later, when our majority came to prominence, and the British, who had written him off in 28, discovered in 33 he was chancellor. You may
may not know just by the people who are on the scene. We have commented about Joseph Strauss. We have commented about the heir to the Habsburg throne, Otto of Habsburg. Jesus speaks about the times of the Gentiles at the close, at 3.5 year time of crisis, when the armies of Babylon tread down the city of Jerusalem in its environment and imposed their will throughout much of the Middle East, including Egypt. Jesus said, whoever reads the book of Daniel should understand. So let us note what Daniel really says in this 11th chapter in connection with the nature of a final crisis. Now the story of this is not the story of the end of Daniel chapter 11, but it goes back to an earlier part. It's the story of Antiochus Epiphany. At the time appointed, he returned, verse 29, he gets into trouble in Egypt with the Roman ships, the ships of Kittim, and then he comes to the temple, he profanes the temple, verse 31, and the fortress, and takes away the continual burnt offering, and sets up the abomination that makes desolate. Jesus said he should understand that something that happened in the days of Antiochus Epiphany long ago in the 2nd century B.C. is a type of the final judgment. So that even though the man mentioned at the end of the chapter is the final individual in character, is described as that of Antiochus Epiphany. Jesus said, look to the story of Daniel, which is here fulfilled by Antiochus Epiphany, 168 to 165, or 167 to 164 more precisely, in that period of time. In that period of time, there arose this man, who is considered a type of the final ruler. Now note the nature. This man is introduced in the longest discussion of him has had. He is introduced in chapter 11, verse 21, as the king of the north. As the king of the north. And the whole thing from chapter 11, verse 21, through what I have just been reading, verses 33, into verse 33, is talking of Antiochus Epiphany, and he's the type of the last man. Let me tell you what this man is like. In his place shall arise a contemptible person, to whom royal majesty has not been given. He shall come in without warning, and attain the kingdom by flattery. Verse 24, without warning, he shall come into the richest parts of the province. And of course, he deals with duplicity. So you can notice that all the way through here. You should read it. I would only tell you, well, it does not discount who the beast could be. But I want you to know that there was a kingdom already extant to which this person comes. And Antiochus came into the kingdom that already was there. Revelation 17 shows that the kingdom, the 10 nations, have power and authority, and they give it to a man. There was a king in Italy, and Mussolini raised him from the level of king to emperor, Victor Emmanuel. There was no ruler like this in Germany. The Hitler took the role of both chancellor and ultimate leader. Napoleon was similar, but the Habsburgs were before were quite different. An empire was already there, and then there is a man who, let's say, comes to great prominence in the sequence. I perceive 1982 as a time of economic crisis. It certainly will be if we continue our economic policies in this country, affecting all currencies by our policy of continued inflation. I see, therefore, a political attempt at an economic level. But I do not want you to assume that Europe is put together by the man. But rather, he comes into prominence. He's described as contemptible. I will only warn you, before you draw conclusions, Franz Josef Strauss is not a contemptible person. He's the most brilliant man in politics in West Germany. And admitted by his friends and enemies to be so. Otto of Habsburg is a man to whom the world pays respect for his learning, and it would be very difficult for me to perceive spouse or out of a pastor, this word could not apply to either of us. There is coming a man who comes in with flatteries and without warning. Without warning. That's a beautiful translation. Here's twice. In verse 21 and verse 24. He does things without warning. He comes in and seems to be one thing and is another, the least likely man. Europeans are quite afraid of a man like Strauss because he uses his authority to keep communism out. We don't know what role these men will have, to what extent, whether in or out of the parliament, they ultimately put a man in charge who has flatteries, who really is, in a sense, that nobody, if you please, this is like saying that the French, the Germans, the Slavic peoples of Eastern Europe, the Italians, and whoever else is in this union can't agree on any important person. Because a brilliant Frenchman or a brilliant German would not be acceptable to the other party. And a brilliant Italian would be contemptible in the eyes of those north of the Alps. Because of human jealousy. It's like almost saying that in choosing a person like this, they have chosen someone who didn't offend anybody and who ultimately offends God. Just think about this before we draw hasty, premature conclusions. It is good to have your warning signs up. The end is not yet. The church must continue its work. Mr. Armstrong has a job to do. You have a job to do. Or shall I say, we all. We have work yet while we must be patient. This era described in Revelation chapter 3, the only church to whom God said it had to have this special patience. Because what seems suddenly to be at the door turns out not yet to be. And I would only warn you of the crisis coming in the early 80s, and at the same time warn you that men may think they have solved it, and it may go on with apparent solutions, and that sometime thereafter, man whom nobody took seriously, in terms of royalty, would have been contemptible. Hardly a but his ideas are necessary. Hardly a from a certain point of view, but his ideas are necessary. We do not deny that these two men of the architecture